Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys. This is the Books
one and only.
This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Oh, I interrupted you there, Dean.
But it was my fault. I forgot, you'd think after 22 episodes I'd remember which bit comes in which order, but apparently not.
Well, it's very shocking stuff. And you know what's even more shocking?
What?
So I made my way today to the library in Dresden. So I heard of this place. They call it a bibliothek. And supposedly it's a place where they keep books.
So you've gotten out of the supermarket. You've gotten out of the toilet paper aisle. And you find somewhere, you've heard a rumor there might be some books in this building you're in.
Yeah, so it's got a building and there are bathrooms. So I've been inside the bathrooms checking out the toilet rolls.
Sure.
I can't find Shakespeare's complete works of plays. I might have found some P.G. Woodhouse, but I'm not sure. The scripture is a bit
maybe they're sold out of Shakespeare. Did you find, you know, any Plato or anything like that in there?
Well, you see, I didn't find that much at all. I thought it was supposed to be full of these books, but I just found a few handful of toilet papers. That no publication dates. It didn't say if it's first edition or third. Mm. Made in China. So it seems to be very big into the Chinese authors. Postmodern Chinese authors. I think it's a new movement. Postmodern Chinese literature that uses invisible ink and scripture on scrolls. I think that's what the new book is.
Yeah, they love the scrolls in the bathroom section. Do you know, I'm excited because I put it 22 months ago when I made the intro to the show, I said live from the Grand Library. And this is the first time that either of us have actually been in the library during the show.
Oh, so. Well, there you go. I'm literally in a big library. So today, instead of crickets, there are echoey big halls and some disgruntled looking students giving me the look. Mm-hmm. So that's what today's atmosphere is.
So the good news is we don't get sued for lying about where we host the show in a library. And secondly, you didn't bring the crickets with you, right?
I'm afraid I left them in Italy.
Okay,
was hoping that Alex was going to send over a packet from the US, but it hasn't arrived yet.
The good news then is that this episode should be like child's play after the technical nightmare that was last month, which it came out okay in the edit, but it was a lot of work for us.
It was a lot of work and it was last minute. I think we only had a few hours until the end of June.
Yeah, it was the most difficult episode to do, but we got there. So I should just mention quickly, because like schedule's all over the place at the minute. We're recording a few days early as well. Summer gets in the way. You were in Italy, and you know, as you mentioned, our other co-hosts from Playboys, Alex and so on, everyone's traveling around. I'm just back from a week and a half in Spain myself, so everything's a little bit last minute. I spent two entire days just dancing on the beach to Spanish music. 14 and a half hours, you know, dancing to Spanish music on the beach. I saw a whole load of bands that probably no one listening will ever have heard of. And then I went to this very fancy garden in Barcelona and I saw Kool and the Gang playing under a Juliet's balcony in a very lovely setup. And then I saw French singer Zaz, and I watched her car get mobbed by the fans, like paparazzi taking photos through the window of her car, which I thought was a little bit disrespectful, you know. But
so it sounds like you had some literary adventures, some Woodhouseian adventures.
I did, and of course I told myself I'm not going to bring back any books, and then I brought back just four or five, not too many, you know, but just a few books that I got. Some the bookshops in Spain are fantastic, and you know the reread I really love because you get them very cheaply. The new bookshops can be quite expensive in Spain, but I love it. I love to buy the books and bring them home because they have great selection. They have more Dumas, for example, there than we have usually here.
Nice.
Wilkie Collins and all that. You know they have a really good selection. They love their classics. So I got a few. But look, I'm gonna start. I'm going to tell you about the first book I read this month. I have it here. I'll show it to you. It's called Countdown to a Killing by Tom Vaughan McCauley. Now, this book has only just come out this month in July, so it's brand new. So we're one of the first to get our hands on it. And the interesting thing about this book, PJ, is that the entire story is told in correspondence. So it's all WhatsApps and emails. Now, it's about 300 pages, but I read it in one day because it was so addictive, and the conversation style made me want to keep on, you know, constantly reading. Yeah. So as I'm saying, the whole book, it's all WhatsApps and emails. There's no narrative at all. And what? I read all 300 pages in one day because it was so addictive.
Really?
Yeah. It's a brilliant concept. And it is a crime book. And yeah, the author is actually a solicitor himself. So he works, well, I don't know exactly what area of the law he works in, but he's produced this amazing detective novel. And it's called Countdown to a Killing because the idea is that there will be a murder later in the book. And they tell us that. Okay. And sometimes there are little editorial notes that say things like, you know, guys, just bear with us. We promise there will be a murder. Just keep reading and you're waiting for the murder. But what's spectacular is that you really get involved with the lives of the characters and you kind of don't care if the murder ever comes because you're enjoying what you're reading.
And it must be very easy to read, you know, and because we're used to WhatsApp messages and Facebook messages. So it's almost like almost more accessible for the younger generation, even for us. Like,
it is, yeah. I mean, I think it's a fantastic idea. It's very, very novel. Yeah. I've not seen anything done like this before, you know. And as I say, 300 pages. I read it in one day because it's very, very easy to get through. It's just an endless conversation, you know.
Yeah. It does. It's very original. The closest thing I can think of is the Cell novel, which is quite big in East Asia. So basically, it's basically a similar concept, novels through the format of text messages, or I'm not sure if they use WhatsApp messages, but that basically you're reading it from the phone, a new novel, and usually it's like a work in progress. Usually it's like Dickensian, like the new Dickens, like writing the chapter every day, but sending it to your phone. And so, but I like this format even better. I like it. Good. Cool. Why not something else?
Yeah. And so the main chap is a guy called Lomax, and he's been off doing a secondment. So he's basically been off on holidays in Sicily working, but actually he's just kind of having a nice time, really. And then he has to come back to the office and kind of get back to reality. And his boss, Julian, doesn't like him. And, you know, he gives him a bad performance review, even though he did a good job in Sicily, and kind of says, you do a good job, but you're cynical and you're not a company man. You know, you make jokes about me, so give you a bad review and you don't get your bonus this year. And you think, well, this guy Julian's a bit of an ass. But then he's got a lot of stuff himself. He's trying to manage a team that doesn't have enough staff. You know, the bosses aren't giving him resources. He's struggling with coming out as being gay to his dad. He's got a partner who's just an alcoholic and doesn't contribute anything to the, you know, to the rent or anything like that. So, and is actually quite abusive to him. So you actually think, initially you think this guy's the bad guy, and then you realize, no, he's not. He's just a complicated character, you know? And even the main guy, Lomax, isn't that great. You know, he is very cynical and he is, you know, not a yes man, which is a trait that I like. But he struggles with some kind of loneliness himself. He's not very personable. He's immediately kind of not nice to the new girl who starts and this kind of stuff. You know, he's a bit of an anti-hero in some ways and doesn't really care about anyone. But he's obsessed with this girl he met in Sicily, who's this super bohemian girl. But she's also really, really a just a very horrible, unpleasant person. And she's sometimes abusive to him as well, just mean and you know, going around with other guys and calling him a loser and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
and just ignoring him for you know periods of time, and there's one nice character who's Wen Li, this new girl who starts, and she starts in the office, and she initially doesn't like Lomax, but she gets to know him and gets to like him eventually, and actually falls in love with him, and.
Not too many spoilers.
Well, I'd say that's, you know, this is early. Early page kind of stuff, you know. She's a very, very nice character, you know, and I really, really enjoy what she brings because she's supportive. She does get into a relationship that, you know, with someone who cheats on her, but she's really good with Lomax, and I think that they have a good relationship together. So hold on a second. Now, PJ, I think we might be getting a call here.
Good Lord. Who's that?
Hello, you're through to Books Boys. You got both Dean and PJ on the line. Who's calling?
Hello, it's Tom McCauley here.
Ah, Tom! Wow, what a coincidence. We were just chatting about Countdown to a Killing. There, we have an endless series of these coincidences every month. You know,
crazy. Exactly on the right time. Exactly the right time.
That's every amazing, time. Yeah. Impressive. Authors must all be telepathic. I don't know. I don't know how they do it.
It's special connection. Special book instinct. Well, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Very pleased to join you. And, you know, I'd heard some complimentary things you said about the novel. So it was a great chance to talk to you guys about it. So thanks very much for having me.
That's right. I also submitted a little review. I read this in a day, like I was just telling BJ there, genuinely. The way that it flows with the snippets of WhatsApps and emails just made it such that I couldn't put it down. It was just an endless conversation that I thought, well, I want to find out what, you know, who says what next, and I couldn't. And you're building up to the murder, of course, as well. So you keep thinking, hey, we've got to keep going, you know?
Yes, I think it's great to hear that. I think that the thrust towards the crime, it does keep one on one's toes, although, of course, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek and, you know, on one level is a sort of, not a pastiche of the crime fiction, but sort of is taking that slightly lighthearted beat while exploring perhaps deeper issues.
Yeah, okay. I was saying there as well, there's some issues so I was talking about the characters before you rang in. And of course, would it be safe to say that apart from maybe Wen Li, who I think is a lovely person, Lomax and Julian, they have really good qualities and also some bad qualities. And I think that it's just a lot of characters struggling with aspects of normal life. And some of them have, you know, maybe some loneliness issues and relationship issues and just trying to fight their way through existence almost.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, because people were saying, you know, some reviews were saying, oh, it's a cast of eccentric characters, and I said, well, actually it is and it isn't. It is, but actually that's because we are privy to their private messages and emails, and if you got an average bunch of people from the street or work, you know, they're probably no more eccentric than the average person. And, you know, and I think that the thing that does bind them all is indeed the loneliness. And they're all kind of hiding that in different ways. And it's interesting to say about Wen, because many people have said she's, you know, clearly got oodles of you know, kindness, etc. Although I always thought that, you know, perhaps she was a little bit needy as well sometimes. And I think Lomax says that in an area. So she's, but you're absolutely right about the other characters. And, I felt that you know, the structure of the novel really goes to show the different sides, because you're presented, you know, for example, Julian as the sort of horrible boss with a mean name for him, the rat witch, and then
rat witch.
Little do you know that he's in the same room emailing his abusive partner, and you know, is in this horrible toxic relationship. So yeah, but it's good that it's interesting that you picked up on that loneliness thing, because I think that does pervade all the characters' lives actually.
Yeah, and you're perfectly right about Julian. Initially, you don't like him until you find out a bit more about him and you realise, you know, oh, he's actually a very sympathetic character, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. He's some people have actually said to me that actually he's the favourite character, because
Yeah, because the sort of, I think anybody who's, I mean, I you know, I'm not a boss, but I think anyone who's been a boss must feel frustrated that, you know, you've got these two people, Wen and Lomax, who are sort of demonizing him in some way.
Mm.
And yet they're actually not the ones doing much work. They've got limited responsibilities and he's the one trying to keep the ship afloat and is, you know, and is having just as tough a time, if not far tougher than them. So yeah, apparently it came across quite sympathetically.
Yeah. My favorite character is Wen's mum, even though we don't really see her. She doesn't do a lot in the novel, but it's just when you see the little text and Wen's like, no, he doesn't want to read my poems from when I was a kid. You know, he can't even read Chinese. You know, it's like, no, stick to the recipe. Why have you made something different? Mom, please. I love it. It's very good.
It's nice to say that because I think that people were saying it was interesting that the correspondence is one-sided from all the characters. But actually, I think that, well, obviously that's very deliberate, sort of conscious literary device, but also I think it does allow you to get your own impression of the characters who you never actually hear from directly, whether that be the abusive Toby, you know, Julian's partner, or Wen's mum, you can just see running around and stressing her out sort of thing. And hopefully it brings them to that. And Katie, you know, stuck in the law firm all night just listening to reading these endless emails from her sort of slightly lonely friend.
I couldn't figure out the dynamic there. So PJ, there's this friend, Katie, that Lomax has. Mm-hmm. He emails her every week. In theory, once a week, but sometimes more. Sort of regular updates about his life. And then eventually she accidentally kind of, you know, forwards on a reply where she kind of isn't too kind to him and they fall out for a while. But it's just his loneliness again coming out. He wants someone to talk to and to give little updates to, you know?
Yeah, I just loved how Lomax's kind of view of the world is sort of wonderfully diverse from the reality, you know. So he's sitting there in this small flat with a leaky roof, and he's writing these slightly grandiose emails to this friend of his who's clearly far more successful than him and
got
a lot more going on in her life. And but he's really getting into his emails and sort of. And I thought that was important, that because not many people, or not, you know, it's a certain type of person who writes those type of long emails. So I think it needed to be a wannabe writer who was, you know, lost in his own dream of doing something special. And she just puts up with it, I think. She, you know, she kind of puts up with this. And as you say, she then finally cracks one night and says to her husband, God, I've had this, you know, this crap through from Lomax again. But unfortunately, she sends it to Lomax, which is quite painful to her to read.
But you mentioned a key detail there, and so this might interest you, PJ, is that Lomax is a writer like yourself Tom. So he initially wants to write a kind of sequel to Agatha Christie's and Then There Were None called And Earlier There Were Ten, kind of a backwards version, which which he realizes, you know, after some time is not going to work.
And then he gets into this, I think he writes it and then the reviewer says to him, oh, that's really, really funny. And he's devastated because it wasn't meant to be funny. So he then realizes that his latest mad then idea is to actually, I'll make it really, really funny and I'll make it as bad as it could be. So it's a sort of pastiche So yeah, it's just he's constantly on the lookout for brilliant literary ideas and not really able to execute them very well.
Yeah, he seems to get progress eventually. Like he's in touch with an old college professor or whatever who helped him with literature, and she gives him some tips. She's not always necessarily there for him when he needs her, but
no. And I thought there's that sort of thing that I deliberately tried to subtly bring in. Like maybe he's driving this poor lady mad as well. You know, that he keeps referring to it as Professor Nithicott because he's proud that he's got this backer, but actually. Maybe she doesn't really reply for quite a while.
But I like his view of the world. And I was sad when Julian said, you know, you did all right at your job, but, you know, you're cynical and you make jokes and you're not a company yes man. And I thought, good, you know, promote this man.
Exactly. Exactly.
It does sound like a very realistic book, to be honest. I mean, you know, people writing WhatsApp messages, sometimes people writing loquacious emails and not getting answers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's to do with self-esteem as well. And, you know, it's that classic, he hasn't got any self-esteem in his job. Where he gains his self-esteem from is his big dream that, you know, that one day he'll be out of here and and doing his thing. And I think many people can relate to that who do any job.
It makes me think there are probably many novels in private WhatsApp conversations, because those are very long messages. Put them all together, edit it a bit, and you might have some very interesting insights into their lives. Maybe even truer literature than what they might try to write artificially, feel like.
Yeah, that's why I chose this medium, actually, because I was like, you know, it seems to be a really... Well, one, it's kind of a very recent development, isn't it, for like humans generally, that we're putting down in messages stuff that wasn't really made for written correspondence, you know, like, so in the old days, if you said, oh, Tom's a real idiot, you would know that you were just saying that to let off steam and you didn't mean to state on the record. Yeah. But then if I read your WhatsApp about me saying that, that would be very hurtful. And if you think about it, we're therefore all capable of having hurt virtually everyone close to us one time or another through a WhatsApp. And I thought that was quite, I've always thought that's quite a scary development. And maybe future generations will think, what were we doing? You know, committing all this to sort of the written permanent word when actually we didn't mean most of it.
Yeah. I mean, we produce more written material than any civilization in history. It's insane. The amount of just data.
Yeah.
90% of which is, you know, mundane.
Mundane and just our thoughts at the time and not our real opinion. And, you know, there's a sort of doomsday scenario that someone leaks all WhatsApps to everyone or something and then everyone falls out with everyone they've ever known. You know,
it also makes for both, I feel like it can make both for a raw story and yet also cruder maybe as well, like crude and raw. So it's like a mixture of it could be a deeper real literature, or it could be a really superficial literature. And it feels like you're playing around as both of them.
Yes. Yeah. So because Lomax is this creative person, he writes these long, you know, wannabe beautiful descriptions of everything he's doing and then meandering. And then you've got the British Chinese girl who's much more to the point with short and sharp WhatsApps, which sort of break up the rhythm somewhat, you know. So
yes, she's very much just here's what's happening, and she's a sympathetic character, you know, even before what happens with her parents. She's sympathetic, just, you know, she's taking on a new job, she's got some kind of her own kind of mental health issues and things like that. She does have the loneliness. She's willing to date a guy that cheated on her just because I think she doesn't want to be lonely, and Lomax doesn't seem to want her, and it's sad at times, you know.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you picked that up, because there is a sort of element of not really darkness but sadness pervading some of these characters, and I think that the Wen and Lomax thing is exactly that he's got these self-esteem issues and doesn't really think that it would ever be a go with her because she's such an all-round, you know, fascinating person, and instead he's going after this really sort of odd character in another country. And
you've took me where I wanted. I'm going to ask you a question about her in a second.
I was just going to say, and then Wen is clearly also got self-esteem issues and is lonely and is going out with this, you know, we all know the type, don't we, some sort of young city guy who thinks he's top dog and actually isn't very nice, and she could do a lot better than him.
Yeah. So tell us about the girlfriend in Sicily, you know, because a very interesting character, and maybe the only character that I don't like, you know.
Yeah.
She doesn't do anything that makes me like her the way maybe Julian does. The more you see about him, you think, oh, he's not a bad guy, really. She's just kind of not, she's mean. She's mean.
She's mean, and it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the obvious point about her is you don't get to hear her voice back.
Yeah.
And that was sort of deliberate, and in the postscript to the novel, without giving anything away, there's a sort of slightly jarring bit about, you know, it is noted that Aurora made a serious allegation about Lomax. And that's what I wanted to do throughout, just put this slight, I don't think there is any doubt because of the third party experiences of what happened there, but maybe there's this doubt that maybe it wasn't actually as straightforward as everything you've just read. And maybe Lomax was a bit, you know, was not, not a dark character, but maybe not. And I think, yeah, I think the interesting thing about her was that I thought it was important because there's a lot of positive female characters in the novel. And I thought there's nothing wrong with sort of having a balance there and having a sort of the type, you know, a female, not stereotypical female either, but a female type who perhaps isn't great, because I think that it is important to show the full round, and you don't want to have this situation where, you know, Wen's clearly the nicest character, Katie's the most solid and successful, all the men are damaged. And I thought it was balancing to have the type of female character that that, you know, is probably not as that common, but you know, clearly does exist, and hopefully manage to delicately towards the end, you know, give the impression that actually it's not just that she's unpleasant, but she may have, you know, real issues herself. So, but I just thought it fitted well with Lomax, because, you know, he needed to be sort of in love with someone who was so obviously on paper not a great person, mm-hmm. but he was constantly in his quest to sort of have this happy ending to his life.
When he has a better option presenting itself to him, he sticks like, no, I have to go back to this toxic girl, you know?
Well, as many artists are, he's romantic, right? In the sense of he's romanticizing someone who is not really what he expects.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's distance, and it's, you know, it's based on a short, passionate experience abroad, and that sort of thing is so different from the sort of humans that we know on the basis of regular day-to-day correspondence. So you're right, that's exactly the word, he's deeply romanticized her, and it's sort of comical and slightly painful when he sort of gives the objective story of what happened that day. And the reader can clearly see, oh, God, man, she, you know, go away. But he's sort of explaining it was actually romantic or something, you know.
And lastly, we should mention Fifi. PJ, yes. Fifi's this Italian, he's a dwarf. And we also see a lot of problems with his family, because his family have fallen out with him. You know, they don't get on with him. Really, it seems that his height is one of the driving forces there, but he's just a lovely, lovely person. And he's very fiercely defending Lomax, his new friend. He attaches himself like super kind of, I want to hang out all the time and I'm here to defend you and all this kind of stuff, you know, let me at him kind of Scrappy-Doo style, almost like, you know, I'm sticking up for you. But he's a lovely, lovely guy. And you feel really bad for him when he reaches out to his family and they're just not interested, you know?
Yeah, I think that was, because obviously, you know, with the drive that I fully support, you know, about sort of inclusive writing. And I do think that people with restricted growth probably is a real area which hasn't been explored. And it's so easy to write about them and sort of be, you know, to read about them and sort of it could have been comical or mean or something, you know. And I thought, what about, you know, inverting that and really giving him humanity and the sadness and respect. And actually in some ways he's the hero of the novel. And you know, and so yeah, it was quite interesting reading about that, and it's this sort of classic thing, isn't it, where it could be comical from Lomax's perspective in some ways, mm-hmm. on a superficial level, but if you think about it, you're like, but that's just as mean as any of the other stereotypes that we're addressing in the book, such as, you know, ethnicity or sexuality or whatever. So it deserves, you know, equal delicacy.
And Lomax isn't necessarily such a good friend back. He's not a terrible friend, but he's not, you know, he doesn't really care, you know.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about Lomax. He's clearly good-hearted and is, you know, prepared to defend him, but equally is so wrapped up in himself that, and as you say, that's the, when people say, oh, Lomax is just this lovely character or lovable, it's like, well, he's very human, like he's not perfect, actually, and does tend to see everything from his own dramatic, you know, overly dramatic view of what is a rather unremarkable life.
I have one question for you, because, you know, you're a solicitor and you wanted to write a crime novel. Was there any what prevented you, and thank goodness it, you know, it did, because this novel's amazing, but was there any desire to be like, right, I'm gonna do like a John Grisham style, just intricate legal thriller, or did you immediately say no, like that's not what I want to do?
It was actually originally I was thinking more of it sort of, the crime came about sort of later in the thought process, actually. So it was more that I really wanted to write about these different characters and use the form and particularly the idea of multiple stories playing out, and the crime sort of genre just appealed, because with something like that you really do need an impetus and a structure, otherwise you're going to get lost in all these people's stories without any narrative thrust. So I just find that the crime genre is great for giving impetus to the story. And as I say, it's tongue in cheek, but at the same time, you are driven on to find out, well, what does actually happen here? Yeah. But no, I've never so far written a thriller like that, actually. But yeah, hopefully it still gives a bit of, you know, page turn focus.
It does. And so this has only just come out. So do you want to tell us, like, is there, have you already got ideas for what's next or take a break?
Yeah, writing the novel didn't take as long as my first one. So it was kind of like one or two years on and off. And then it just took a while to get it published. You know, it's as we probably all know, the publishing world and agency world is quite slow, to say the least. And so that did take a while of false starts, and or rather me focusing too much on a particular publisher and then, you know, revising it. And so in the meantime, was writing a third one, which is different, very different from this. So actually, you know, that's a really nice thing about having a novel published, because you've got, you think that's just off my plate now. You know, people can say what they want, but I'm not touching that again. And it's really nice to just revisit these drafts and, you know, it's almost like a blank page again, or even though it's quite developed. So yeah, the third one will be very different.
Nice. Do you want to tell us real quick where we can go to get this one then? Do you want to give us a plug?
Tell
us where to get the book.
Oh yeah, so it's in Waterstones. It's obviously Amazon's very easy to get. It's WH Smith seem to be stocking it as well, and I think lots of independent bookshops, I've been told, have got it. So, but Waterstones certainly would be the obvious one on the high street.
Cool. I'll put a link in the show notes anyway, just to your site and things like that, so people can check it out. Well, PJ, do you have any other questions before I ask the usual final question?
Well, I do want to know, can you tell us briefly what inspired you to write the novel? Ultimately, was it looking at WhatsApp culture, or was there a specific incident maybe that kind of triggered one point of the story?
Yeah, it was the first one of those, actually. So it really was kind of, if I'm going to write the second novel, how are we going to make it relevant? It was during the period where, you know, Netflix had really kicked off, and it was like, is the novel, you know, which is still the discussion now, is how relevant is the novel? And then I thought, well, you know, how do you write something which doesn't become, you don't want this, it's either a novel or it's this kind of very comic book type, you know, colourful WhatsApps, which would bore everyone. And it's like, how can you turn that into a, you know, realistic, but into a proper novel telling? And I used to enjoy epistory novels as well, like the old fashioned ones. And so I thought, give it a go. And I thought, but it does have to have a character who likes to write, otherwise it would be very tedious to read. And the WhatsApps are, you know, a very small percentage of the text.
Cool.
Yeah. Very good. Well, our last question I asked everyone, and I never let anyone prep for it, so I'm going to spring this one on you. But if there's any book that exists, essentially it's what's your favorite book, but not quite. If there's any book that exists that you wish you'd been the author of, what would it be?
Wow. Okay. So... 100 Years of Solitude is obviously...
Oh, yes. There you go, PJ. You love that one.
Sorry. I guess I'm Marcus for the listeners.
Right. It's just, I just find that novel... I read it at university, had to, and it's the only novel. It sounds really weird what I'm about to say, but I was going off to the exam and I read the end again just before the exam. And there's a line when it says, and then the wind began. And I actually felt some wind. And I was like, Jesus, I mean, it's the way this guy writes. And again, it was, you know, very intertextual. I would, you know, unless, in case people haven't heard of it, I won't give it away. But the idea that you're reading a book that may be a book that someone else is writing within the novel, and that it's self-referential and all that. I'd love all that.
Brilliant. Well,
I actually do mention it in almost every episode.
He mentions it a lot, and I've not read it yet.
One of my Desert Island books. And the same with you. When I read that ending, I was at a stormy beach. And I was out spoiling anything, but obviously it was a perfect place to read such an ending. And I felt many times throughout the books these different emotions and feelings. And I laughed out loud. And it's also comic and tragic. It's beautiful.
Yes. Yes.
It's a great choice. There we are then. Tom, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for calling in. And I absolutely love the book. So whenever I hear tell that the next one's out, I'll be sure to pick it up.
Oh, well, thanks very much, guys. Really enjoyed that chat.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah, take care.
Take
it easy.
Bye.
See you.
Well, there we go. Series of endless coincidences, but brilliant, brilliant book. Countdown to it.
And I am delighted that he chose 100 Years of Solitude. So there you go.
I know, you love it.
I know you're skeptical about your Latin American literature, but it is a quintessential novel, as I always say.
All right. Well, I'll take 2 minutes here before we move on just to mention to everyone. So booksboys.com is our website. You can find links to their various things on there, including our Patreon. And you can just go directly to patreon.com/booksboys as well. And you can get the extra shows that we do. So this month, what's just come out, you're probably thinking these have been going on forever, but the final episode of Interviews from the Vault, episode 15, where I interview Danny Seraphine, the original drummer from the hit band Chicago. If you leave me now, you take away the biggest part of me. So I interviewed him for his solo album 9 years ago, and you can catch that on the last Interviews from the Vault. We also released this month some Playboys Extra, Luthes de Bohemia. With Mireia, we talked about the Valle Inclán play, a Galician author. And
it's a great play.
Yeah. And we also did the Lorca play, The House of Bernarda Alba. So there's been a couple of episodes out this month. So basically what you can get on our Patreon is Playboys, where we review plays. A lot of Shakespeare's on there. I think 14 or 15 Shakespeare's, a couple of other things. Plus you got Film Fellows, Dark Place Dreamers, Caper Captains, and a whole mishmash of crazy things. So
we got two random Norwegian plays just for fun, just for the Norsk fan.
We do. We got a lot of stuff on there. We got some Poetry Pals, Music Men, Games Guys, you know. So check it out, guys, on the Patreon, and you can get yourself a Books Boys t-shirt, and you can recommend books for us to read and all that kind of stuff. And then that helps us, and that means I can afford another trip to Spain. So, you know,
and which would lead to further Instagram photos of Dean posing with books, and we all need that. The world needs that just as much as World Peace, right?
Yeah, it's very, very important on the top. The UN meetings, they're saying we need more book photos from the Books Boys, you know, so it's on there. So the other thing I will say as well is booksboys@hotmail.com if you want to get in contact with us. Mm-hmm. And of course you can do that, or you can also use social media. We have a comment from Kyle McKay who says, just came across you guys. I'm trying to get back into reading more. You guys are really cool and really informative on the good books that are out there. So thank you, Kyle.
We appreciate your comments. And yeah, feel free to write anything, guys. Give us book recommendations. Send us your books as well, please, so we can read it and maybe even organize an interview if possible in our timetable.
That's it.
Feel free.
So, PJ, do you want to tell us what you've read this month?
Indeed. So what I've read is I've read Dino Buzzati. Now, do you know this chap, Dean?
I can't say I've ever heard of him.
Okay, so Dino Buzzati is an Italian author who wrote mainly in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And he was famous at his time, but he has, even in Italy, lost a bit of popularity. The most famous thing he's maybe written also outside Italy is the famous Invasions of the Bears in Sicily, which has become a children's film.
Is this book available in English, PJ?
Yes, so I have informed myself. So this time it is. So this time it is. He's... As I said, he was famous enough with his novel, The Tartar Steppe, his third novel, which was quite famous in the 40s. But anyway, this is a really important book. It's called La Boutique del Misterio. So basically the boutique shop of mystery.
Sure, of course.
Indeed. And I got this on my first day in Italy because I had read one of his short stories before, and I consciously seeked him out. Just any book of his. And I'm glad I took this, because this is the best book to start with, because he unpurposely compiled his favorite 31 stories. I have the quote here. Let me just get the quote for you, Dean, here, so you can trust my authenticity. 1 second. He said, with a loose translation, he said, I lost it now, what he said. He said, 31 stories put into order by Dino Buzzati with the hope of making the reader know his best selected works. So it's a good book to start off with, because it's a compilation of, I think, 3 books of short stories. He's written about 150 short stories. It's quite a lot.
Goodness me, wow.
And it's a delight, honestly. Every short story is memorable. Every short story has a very interesting philosophical theme. So he's from the existentialism era, but he's a lot more into the fantasy realm. He's a lot more into the more Camus vibe than Camus or Sartre would be.
and a bit less into the do we exist vibe. He doesn't often question our own existence. But God, for example, often appears in the book almost like a sci-fi character who doesn't talk. Let me start off with one of his, probably his first short story, because it's in the first story selection he wrote. It's called The Seven Messengers, I Sette Messaggeri. Still one of his best known stories. This is basically about a prince who decides to explore the kingdom of his father and who day by day goes distance himself from the city and from the news of anyone. And this becomes rare and rare. Sorry, that was a very loose translation of the beginning, but that's basically how the story begins. And he has seven messengers who he gives them alphabetical names. And what he does is he sends back the messengers to his hometown, home city. But the problem is, Dean, the more distance he makes from the city, and he thinks he's about to reach the border. He thinks, well, we're going to reach the border in a few weeks, lads. Don't worry about it. But no, it's just there seems to be no end to the kingdom. And every time he sends a messenger, the letter he gets back obviously becomes rarer and rarer.
Right.
Until like years pass by without hearing back from him. And he just describes like that the letters he receives back don't make sense to him. The emotions, they seem to be archaic. The language seems to be outdated. And it's a bit maybe extreme because only 8 years have passed, but it makes it sound like he's been going for centuries and centuries. And he kind of hopes that the weather he's experiencing, the birds he hears are the same, but it's kind of like a illusion because he feels like, well, this is not like my hometown and I feel like a stranger. So we got the theme of stranger. Now this story was written about 1940s, so it is a very existential story, but still big kind of fantasy element, I feel, because a lot of the landscapes he uses are very vague kind of fantasy. Is this even earth kind of landscapes? So without getting into all the stories, obviously, I'll just mention my favorite ones. That is one of my favorite ones from the same book, is the story Seven Floors, not Seven Messengers, Seven Floors. And this is an interesting concept. Yeah, I think this is one of the more interesting philosophical concepts of the book. It's kind of like about the philosophy of the institution of health. So do you think that if someone goes into a hospital, okay, but they call it more like a health house. So this guy's going into the hospital because he's got some kind of disease and he's here that in this place, they can cure it easily.
Yeah.
And if you go to the seventh floor, the top floor, that's for people with hardly any illnesses, jolly people. They just feel slightly ill at ease. And the worse the illness becomes, the lower down you go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What happens is, there's always an element of absurd more than existentialism, Dino Buzzati, by a series of more like bureaucratic mistakes and coincidences. He seems to go lower down every time. But this is an interesting point, because the atmosphere is always slightly darker, slightly more pessimistic, slightly more sick-orientated. He also gets sicker.
Ah.
So do you think that makes sense? Or do you think that's just fiction? Do you think like your environment, the concept is the environment around where you stay in makes you the person you are, healthy or sick?
Yeah, I think that definitely.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting concept because he's not sick at all, but he does get sick and he gets infections the lower down he gets, and his morale really decreases and the doctors become slightly more pessimistic.
Mm-hmm. And, the environment that you're in will play a massive, massive part on things like that. Yeah, I think that's sounds like a very good concept.
Right, yeah. And it's a horror story. So again, it's really weird for the time, I find, because he's kind of a horror, science fiction, fantasy, existentialist, absurdist writer. So that's Seven Floors. And there's always an element of really black humor in it as well. There are stories here of aliens, of saints who live in a place where God is a lake. Right.
PJ, are there seven aliens and seven saints?
You would think so, but he kind of leaves it though. He just does two stories. Sadly, I wish he had like seven. he's got a story, for example, of a drop of water terrorizing the flatmates, because the drop of water is alive and it's going up the stairs rather than down the stairs. But the flatmates are embarrassed because they don't want to tell their neighbors, because obviously that's just, you know, they think they're crazy. So the drop of water is literally terrorizing one flatmate after the next. It's really weird because I would think that would be more of a David Cronenberg, more of an 80s concept, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Not something for the 40s and 50s. So that's Dino Buzzati. My favorite story of all is the longest one. It was 28 pages. It's called The Dog Who Saw God. It's the only story I mentioned more. It's basically, it's playing around with, is this god, this dog a god? Because this dog has been, it's the dog of a hermit. And he had been sending the hermit bread. Now, one day a big light appears in the forest where the hermit and the dog lives, and the hermit dies. And when the dog comes back, he seems to be very non-dog-esque. He seems to be looking into the souls of everyone living, judging people. And people begin to kind of believe that God is in the dog. Right. So this is a really immoral kind of village. And everyone becomes really Christian bit by force. It's like kind of a God-dog dictator. And that's what the story is about. Again, it was a horror element, a comic element. It's about this whole town being forced to Christianity just because there's a dog there who might be God.
Very, very interesting. So it sounds like these are good stories. I would like to maybe read something by Dino.
Yeah, have a look, as there are several different collections of different names of Dino Buzzati. I don't think any one of them is called literally The Mystery Boutique. But find his short stories, because they're very short. He's got one called 60 Stories, which are just short stories of 3 or 4 pages.
Mm.
And great stories, very kind of sci-fi existentialist. There's one about mice taking over a house and terrorizing the family. There's the one that I mentioned was that saints, after they die, they kind of get to live in this holiday resort where God is a lake. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of neighbors, but one of them gets jealous because he doesn't get any letters from his from people praying, because no one prays for him. He's kind of forgotten saint. So I love the concepts.
Well, I want to say one thing. Well, two things. The first thing is the title, The Boutique of Mysteries. It made me think of the Mr. Ben cartoon, actually. I don't know if you remember the Mr. Ben cartoon. I think he was going to go in, and just by magic, the shopkeeper appears. And then he takes him to like a mystical world in the dressing room of the shop. It's an old, 2D kind of cartoon from a long time ago. Yeah. But the second thing is, BJ, there's one thing I'd really love to hear about. I don't know if you heard of the book called Discovery of Heaven. I feel like I don't have enough information about that book to date.
The Discovery of Heaven has been at last finished. And we'll move on to that now, because I don't want to mention it, because I believe it had over an hour and a half. If we added two episodes together of
Congress. Yeah, I think it's been a lot.
Look, all I can say is I've got one negative aspect to say about it. I was disappointed by the ending, which was a bit of a letdown, because I really loved the book. You know how I loved the book. I went on and on about it. And I loved it so much I could hardly describe it. I was like a child before Christmas talking about it. Really a great book. I don't have much more to say than last time. But the ending, I feel like, did you have to write that ending? Very disappointing. Very, very kind of like a bit of a letdown. I was expecting more of a grandiose God is going to kick you in the, without using any swear words. But it was a bit more realistic, perhaps, than I would have liked.
Okay. Not a fan of the realism this time. Well, fair enough. At least you finished it,
At least I finished it. But again, highly recommend it, guys. It goes very religious in the end. It does go very into religious history, not religious per se, which I don't know how I feel about it. It was well done, but only if you're interested in that.
Mm.
So I have to kind of let people down a bit about the ending.
Oh, there we go. I'm going to play next. We got the following voicemail. I don't know if you've heard of this lady, PJ, Anne Wedgwood.
I believe I have.
So I'm going to play this.
Hi, Dean. Hi, PJ. How are you? If I know anything about you guys, you've got a nose stuck in a book, but I hope you'll bring it out long enough to hear a message from me. I remember that you enjoyed my book, The Botanist, last year, and I thought you might like to know that I brought out a new one. It's called The Soloist, and it's another murder mystery. It's another twist in the tale novel, so it's starring D.I. Ronnie Twist again, and it's set in the very wonderful town of Beverly. This one's a little bit different from the last one. It's not got an old lady as a protagonist. It's a young girl called Scarlet. The first line goes like this. I couldn't kill Max Salento. He was already dead. I hope that will hook you in. I hope you'd like to know who Max Salento is, why he was dead, and why Scarlet wanted to kill him. The whole thing is all about a race against time for Scarlet as she tries to find out who's actually killed this man before she gets arrested and put in jail. Anyway, I'll send you a copy over so you can have a look at it. Hope you enjoy it, and I'd love to hear what you think about it. Bye.
Wow.
Bye to yourself, man. So there we go.
It's lovely hearing from you, man. And thanks very much. Yeah, you have it right there. It's a lovely cover, actually.
The solo, it's very nice. Yeah, and you see this little piano just there in the woods, you know?
Oh, I like that. It's a bit more Cameo-ian, actually, that cover.
It is a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
Well, so what can I say about this? I'm keeping on my crime theme from the last book. And this is another one. Again, it's about 250 pages, something like that. I think I read this one in 2 days. You know, these are...
You're a fast reader, yeah.
I'm a fast reader, but they're also addictive books.
Yeah. Totally.
And I took this one up to Hillsborough Forest Park, and I sat by the lake with the geese, and I read to the geese, you know. So if you want to see, again, on our Instagram, if you want to see me trying to get the geese to read, you can find that.
I believe last time you tried to get the swans to read Wilkie Collins was even more challenging.
Yes. Now, they're
this
fans.
This is more realistic.
I'm winning them over.
Good.
So this... this book, The Soloist, is, as Anne said, a race against time. So we have this girl, Scarlet, and I think she didn't have the most pleasant of childhoods, some issues with her mom and this kind of thing. So she's sort of a vulnerable person, and she's doing care work. And eventually this lady says, look, I don't want, you know, these carers coming in and out and different people. And, you know, come live with us. We'll pay you a salary and you can be my dedicated, you know, live-in carer. Not even 24/7. You'll have your kind of your time off and things as well, but just someone regular to live in the house for Ada, this lady. And so she does it. So that's grand. And then this lady, Ada, says to her, one thing, though, I would like to maybe make some provision for you in my will, because they develop a rapport and a relationship. But the condition of that is that when I get to the point where I start to lose my mind, you've got to kill me.
All right. Interesting concept.
And this girl's quite vulnerable and quite susceptible, and she agrees to do it. And they say, but, you know, we're going to inject some morphine in between the, I think it's between the toes, but they have a foolproof method to do it. Poison, okay, and then an air bubble, I think, between the toes. There's a system. But they say, look, we need to make sure it works. So we need to practice on Max Salento.
Oh, Lord.
And this poor girl, Scarlet, doesn't know Max Salento. She doesn't know why they need to kill him. She's just told he's a threat to the family. And that's it. She's got to go and do the murder. Now, most of what I've just told you, we discover a few chapters in, because the opening of the book is that she goes to kill Max, finds him, and he's already dead, as Anne said.
Wow.
So she can't really do the plan. But she's so afraid of Ada, not afraid of Ada, but afraid of disappointing Ada, that she doesn't want to tell her that it didn't work. She just tells her that it all went to plan. As far as Ada knows, she did the murder. And then D.I. Ronnie Twist from
the botanist, yeah,
shows up and says, look, someone's done this murder. You know, what's going on? We know that Max was in the area. They track his, you know, his phone or whatever, and he was near the house before the murders and things like that. And then they look at the cameras and they discover a woman going into the hotel, and there's three women in the house. There's the daughter, the mum, and not the old lady, but there's also Scarlet. So they're trying to figure out, who could it be?
Right.
Now, theoretically, it could have been just someone else, of course. And another woman appears, and that is the partner, the fiancé of Max. But then Max has been cheating, and who's he been cheating with, and all this kind of stuff. And then there's some secrets, because it turns out that Max teaches at the same school that the daughter in the house goes to, but
okay,
interested in her or her friend. And, you know, then the parents are arguing and saying one of them went out for a walk the night of the murder, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then the son has a new girlfriend, and they wonder, well, is there any involvement? That one's a little bit more tentative, but could she have potentially been involved? So they try to increase what seems like maybe two or three suspects into actually potentially a few more, you know?
Okay. And it's got some characters from The Botanist. So for those of you listening, we interviewed Anne Wedgwood about episode 7, was it maybe? Episode 6 or 7?
Something like that. 7 or 8, maybe. In around
that. 7 or 8, yeah. Perhaps, yeah. So it's the same universe with one recurring character or more recurring characters?
Really, it's only D.I. Ronnie Twist. I mean, she has a chap with her, but I honestly can't remember if it's the same one or not. Ronnie Twist is the main attraction. Okay.
Yeah, and it sounded very Agatha Christie now, like in the sense of, well, who did it between the... There are more characters coming up bit by bit, and you expect that... So the reader expects that it was a very plain kind of death, but it's not clear at all.
Yeah. And I mean, Anne's a big fan of Agatha Christie and that whole style. And she's always posting on her Instagram pictures of her books with Agatha Christie's books. She loves it. But I really enjoyed this one. I feel bad for Scarlett. You know, you do feel that she's being pressured into a situation. Mm. She starts to get curious. She gets together with a fiance and they form a little team of investigators. She starts snooping around the house. They discover there are, I'm not going to go into what it is, but they do discover there are some secrets within.
And the botanist has an interesting format of going backwards into time, right? So the crime has been committed, just like in the second novel. And then we get to discover how.
Yes. Yeah. So the first novel, we're trying to discover, she's, you know, we know who did it. Whereas this time we don't. Ah, we know who didn't do it.
Okay. That's interesting. Mm. Right. Okay.
So it's a very good concept. And it's a very fun read. So for anyone that likes that style of book, your Agatha Christie styles, your murder mystery type things, I would say, you know, go for it. And the reason it's called The Soloist is because the girl, I think it's Polly, she was going to do a performance with Max Cilento, who she said she never met before, but he taught at her school. And so he's a pianist and she plays a cello, I think it is. And so they were going to go in and do a performance together, you know. So that was this kind of backstory and the reason for the title of the book, you know.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So I really, really recommend that one, and thank you so much, Anne, for getting in touch and for sending that one out.
Yeah,
to
us. Totally. It's lovely hearing from you, and good luck. And as I think you're probably already starting your next book. As far as I know you, so good luck with that or whatever it is you're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. And we love Ronnie Twist. What I like about her is she's never the main character. You know, the books are never from her point of view or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But she's just this kind of good, tough cop that comes in, and then you start to get a little bit tense when she gets around. Yeah.
Well, like, you know, Marple and Poirot, they aren't necessarily the main characters either, right? They usually aren't the main characters. So it's an interesting thing, like, to just these detectives or people just appear and...
Poirot sometimes is, but Miss Marple is almost sometimes, never the main character. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Cool.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.